Hello and welcome, dear listener. This is your daily of the month. Oh, yeah. The Aachener podcast about collaboration and agile organizations.
The tension at the beginning of the episode is palpable. I mean, we were leaving the land of the known and following our guides, Jason and Ian, from Emergent Future Labs into the realm of the unknown. Jason and Ian are two American entrepreneurs and consultants who are pioneering the realm of the unknown, probing their way forward while blocking the underlying paradigms of how we have always done things as a way to co-evolve an emerging future. In collaboration, the two have called the Emergent Futures Labs into being, which has led to the creation of award-winning innovation processes, frameworks, methods, tools, and practices that transform organizations into disruptive innovators to thrive in our changing world. While listening to this dialogue as an observer, I could recognize a false sense of security that I brought to the conversation, maybe caused by my confidence in my role as an innovator. This gave me perspective to see just how radical their approaches are, to understand most of what the innovation that I'm engaged in is incremental in its nature. If you're preparing to listen to this episode, embrace your beginner's mindset, be prepared to go down the rabbit hole with us, because you know we're late for a very important date.
Well, it's a 1 for the money, 2 for the show, 3 to get ready, no go, can't go, don't you step on my date after mine. Yo, hit it.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Daily of the Month. This is Joshua, and I'm happy to be back in the moderator's seat after four months of focusing on life and work. And Chris and Andreas and Franzi took the reins and produced 3 really cool episodes. So if you guys haven't heard any of those, I would strongly recommend it. Today it's in Germany. We're celebrating the Day of Reunification. So the East and West come together and signifies, a new era of Germany. So we're happy to celebrate that day. I spend it out in nature, and now I'm happy to spend it here today with Chris as co-moderator and Jason and Ian. So now I'd like to kind of make a bridge like we usually like to do to the last episode. The last time we spoke with Dr. Klaus Leopold, and he told us about his mental model that he called flight lines, and he created this to help organizational alignment over many different levels of the organization. Today, we're going to be talking about some mental models that Jason and Ian created for their Emergent Futures Lab. But we're also going to be deconstructing some mental models that hinder us from being more creative and innovative. So in my daily business, in my daily life, I'm working as an innovation specialist in a company, a software company, and we're interested in technology and new products and services, but we also spend a lot of time thinking about language and how we can expand the language of the company and what that enables us to do. So we're always joking about being the Shakespeare's of aviation, because our software is written for aviation sector. And so last year, or actually the beginning of this year, I started reading Jason and Ian's work, and it was really, I couldn't quite understand it. They were introducing a new language. It was like partly what they were saying, I'd heard of the terms vaguely, but the way that they were combining them to talk about innovation, creativity, creating new worlds, assemblages, blocking. These are some of the things that we're going to be able to talk about today, and maybe how this journey is going to introduce a new language, who's their audience, and how their vision of the old mental models, how can we deconstruct old mental models of creativity to help us be more innovative. So, Chris?
Yeah. Hi, also from my side. Nice meeting you, Ian and Jason. Very lucky to have you guys with us. And first off, I'd like to state that I'm today kind of the stand-in host. So Marcus had some urgent family business and just want to take the time here to wish him all the best for him and his loved ones. Hang in there, buddy. And so could be that I'll be asking some out-of-the-blue questions now or seem a bit lost in the forest. I will just then say this is due to my short ramp-up time, so have a little joker now in my sleeve. Enough chit-chat. Let's get to it. We have a little break-the-ice thingy we like to start with, and it's our traditional bring a tune slot, I would call it. And we asked you, Ian and Jason, to come up with a nice addition for our jukebox, aka the Daily of the Month's Musical Intentions Spotify playlist. Let's start with, I would say, Jason. So what is it and why is it?
Thanks, Chris. Josh, it's really dynamite to be here with you both. My song is Anarchy in the UK, but by Megadeth. Reason why, first is I think it's a critical song to think about challenging the establishment, challenging the norms, the standard operating procedures, the way things are supposed to be, should be, way we've always done things, the way we blindly follow, without questioning. And, I always had a problem with the Sex Pistols version. It's certainly their style, but it's disjointed. It lacks cohesion from riff to riff. And I think it also, not their fault. It's a product of the time. Certainly 70s punk didn't quite have the energy that the 80s metal brought along with it. And a song like that, I think, really requires much more intensity, in which the Sex Pistols sing it. So, there was, I think, real opportunity to leverage the brilliant lyrics of the Sex Pistols, but listen to it musically by Megadeth. It's a real punch in the face, and that's what this world needs right now.
Great, great. Oh, Ian, I think this will be a tough one to top. But I'm still very curious what you might deliver for our playlist. What's it going to be?
I'm going to go in a totally different direction, but stay with the punk rock universe. And Tanya Tagak, an Inuit experimental musician from what was formerly Northern Canada, her album Animism and the song on it, Animism. She's this astonishing force to be reckoned with that I think, going with what Jason was saying presents an entirely different mode of being alive, and this is what the world needs today, isn't things that keep us in what we understand or what we know, but open us up to new worlds and new ways of being alive and sensing and doing things. And that particular track is all about that. And all of her work is. And so that's where I'd come from. And I think these would go really well together.
Great. So I guess by your two songs, we now heard already some stuff about you, different guys, but you have something in common. You have the thing you created, the Emergent Future Lab. I think Josh already told us something about that. Maybe for me, the new guy, could you sum up what is the mission exactly of an Emergent Future Lab? And could you maybe even phrase that in a kitchen line? I don't know if that translates well. Do you know what I mean by a kitchen line?
I've not heard the phrase of a kitchen line before. Share with me real quick.
Okay, it's kind of a journalist quality thing. So imagine a scene, your partner is in the kitchen and you're in the living room reading a paper. He wants to know what's it about. And so it's very noisy in the kitchen. He doesn't have much time. So just give me not more than two sentences to sum it all up. That would be
Jason up. So forever, we've been frustrated by that when people talk about creativity and innovation, they tell you how important it is, you know, but it never goes beyond that.
And so we focus on answering two questions. It drives all that we do. What is innovation? But most importantly, how do you innovate? And so breaking away from the proclamations and leaving us all hanging at the we must innovate. We must be creative, right? We have a framework to back that up, how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if we put it together to this two-sentence thing, it would be something like, you guys give a method for innovating or a framework.
Absolutely.
Or something like that.
Okay. We're really interested in how you actually do it. And mm-hmm. and the how has to go on far beyond the usual kind of like platitudes of, you know, brainstorm, be more flexible, you know, and even it needs to go beyond just framing in terms of individuals and humans and geniuses and internal creativity and all of the usual cliches, which are real disasters to actual creativity and innovation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think that one of the things that I was really interested to read about is, I think you guys are trying to be a little provocative. You're trying to introduce new language. One of the things you're talking about is challenging the Western idea of creativity. And maybe we have this light bulb idea. Okay, it just happened. It's kind of like a miracle that happens. I'd like to paint a picture for you using a musical metaphor. Maybe you guys can riff off of that. So they came up with the new Elvis video this year, or movie about Elvis. And it's like, he jumps on the stage and it's like the first licks he plays and he starts moving his hips. And it's like, all of a sudden that just freed everyone from the chains that held them. It's like rock and roll's here and we are free. You know, it's kind of like in that moment that he did that, it's like the miracle happened or something. And I think that you guys have maybe something to say about that. Or,
yeah, I mean, I would say the big thing for us, maybe like stepping back from Elvis for a second, but coming back to it, would be that, you know, the West coming from the Greeks, you know, all the way to the 20th century, did not have a place for, you know, worldly creativity, human creativity in the sense we now understand it, that where something genuinely new could be made, you know, and it, God made things, and humans could gain insight into God's plan and make things in his image, you know, was essentially the model we used for creativity. So we today, even though we've put that behind us, I think we still talk about it as if somebody did it. You know, like Elvis freed us, somebody made it come about, rather than seeing how, first of all, it's distributed, you know, that many things are happening in many places. You know, and Elvis is kind of very late to the game, you know, in terms of music. And it's really, if you look at the history of North American music, it's coming out of, you know, blues and early jazz and what have you. But that aside, it's like this model that we always want to pin change, creativity on a person and make this like simple causality radiate out, rather than figuring out what's actually happening.
Yeah. I would just add that, you know, that moment that Elvis, and it's a critical moment, right, in pop culture and, you know, post-war, but the hips were gyrating for generations before, right? It's just that nobody had the gumption to jump on a stage and do it publicly quite yet, right? But there's no mistaking it. It'd been happening before World War II and before World War I, right? And all the back closets and so on and so forth. And so, you know, we've been fighting that moment of hips gyrating on a stage in various forms for centuries, really. It had nothing to do with Elvis. He was made, you know, by all of the evolution of young people for centuries, really. He just happened to be the one that jumped up there and gets that label. That seemingly aha moment.
I'm wondering a bit here if we have this musical example of how much intentionality is in there. I mean, these are youngsters doing music, so with the intention to entertain, to get the ladies or whatnot. But it was maybe not done with like the intention of let's make a revolution of music or have a swinging hip or something. I don't know. Is this really intentional change? It seems like more natural evolving of things, right?
I mean, I think that's something important to get at is when we talk about creativity and innovation, intentionality is not that important, especially in the early stages. You know, the first thing I think that's really important to us is to get people to see that creativity isn't just human. You know, it's happening in the world all around us all the time. Whether we see it in the evolution of creatures like dinosaurs to birds, or, you know, bacteria to all forms of life, creativity is happening. We connect with it and we take advantage of it. Those aren't intentional forms of creativity. And I think, you know, intention like cognition is something that always comes late in the process. When something's radically new, you can't ideate it in that moment. There's nothing. Now, ideation is a very conservative thing. You know, it relies on concepts and words and language and images we already have. So if something's radically new, we don't really see it. We can't articulate it. So it's hard. You know, it's hard to claim intention is there beforehand. And intention is also this kind of top-down model, you know, like this command and control, like I want X to happen, which is going back to the kind of, you know, God model that we inherited. And once we step out of it, we can, you know, see that what we're talking about is something emergent happening that doesn't really come from one source, isn't pinnable in one moment.
I just wanted to maybe make a small shift back to a little bit more pragmatic thing. So the Emerging Future Labs of you guys is a consultancy, if I saw that right, on the website. So people, customers, organizations are coming to you guys with an intention. And I would like to know, what kind of organizations and with what intentions are attending to you and what comes out of it? So maybe give us some life example.
Maybe we'll go back and forth, Fraska.
Sure.
So we've been working. One example is with banks looking at the future of banking and how do you innovate in that space. Another would be
transportation. How do we truly undress the shackles, if you will, going back to Elvis, right, that have been placed on a 100-year-old transportation company, right? We've always done it this way. We need both a cultural shift in the organization and we need a different approach to disrupting and serving ridership.
Then in healthcare, we've worked a lot in contemporary issues of health.
community, real estate, what it means to serve communities, and you know, with, and what is real estate really, what's its purpose in a community, and how can everybody benefit, more inclusive models.
Mm-hmm. So that would be, you know, urban planning, spaces of urban planning and development. You know, I think so the range is really broad. We've also worked around environmental questions, developing products, services, you know, but also, you know, our work is recently is just helping larger organizations help their own, say, diverse customers of businesses develop and utilize actual innovation processes, and, you know, that can help them work with whatever they're interested in working on. And I think there's a dearth of actual techniques.
Okay, but still, I'm not seeing clearly why they are coming to you. So what are they seeking? What should be the outcome of doing something innovational? Or are they just coming for, so like every company, we have to do something innovatively, so consult us, please? Or do they come with a specific need?
I think it's a mixture. I mean, you're getting at something. I know it sounds kind of facetious, but really important that, you know, today there's such radical uncertainty, you know, in so many levels, and that the type of innovation that's required isn't just the type of let's improve what we're doing to meet a known future, but how do we innovate in a highly uncertain climate where we need to develop genuinely new approaches and outcomes. I think that's where our approaches really shine, is they're not about improvement of what exists, but how could you paradigmatically pivot? How could you develop new approaches, worlds, and what have you?
Yeah, and I'd add quickly, you know, so many organizations going to ideation workshops, signing up and implementing idea management software, sticky notes, brainstorming, and recognizing over time the outcomes are all mundane, conservative, conventional. They're all of the known, right? And so I don't think that most people we start to work with don't necessarily, most, not all, have the inclination that they're looking for something different. But then when they engage with our work and our content, they realize that's what's missing, right? Like this whole notion of ideas coming from what exists and what is known. And therefore, they see in our work that there is another way, right, to disruptively innovate, because not for the sake of innovation, Chris, like you had said, but for the sake of their organization's survival, right, and evolution to meet today's, you know, rapidly changing environment, right? And so tools like design thinking, you know, which are best branded tools for innovation. But those that are really paying attention and are willing to, if we go back to the song, like question things, right? Then they recognize design thinking is actually not doing anything disruptive, right? They're empathizing with end users, they're meeting wants and needs, but they're not truly disruptively innovating. And so that's where we kind of come in. We kind of fill that gap where there's a framework to disruptively innovate. It's like it's the first half of innovation that most people overlook and ignore.
Mm-hmm. What drew me, guys, what drew me to your work was that it was, you know, it was new. It felt like you were wanting to express something new. Maybe you guys don't even know exactly what it is, or, you know, you have insight and you're trying to share it with the world. Some of the clients that you or sectors that you're talking about are really close to infrastructure level. Of, you know, banks, roads, I mean, mobility, and those tend to be very conservative, you know, they're infrastructure. So they're, if I look at music, you know, they were innovative faster, and they could change. And now we're looking at, I mean, the systemic things that hold systems together. Do you notice the difference in your clients? Are they able to, and maybe they have to be secure first, you know, they have a special kind of place in the world, because they have to ensure some kind of safety, or even when things are falling apart, but they can support, and they can also maybe constrain our change. But I think I see people who tend to work in these industries are also grounded maybe in similar ideas and ways of being in the past. Is there a difference in the clientele, or do you see engaging with maybe towards radical innovation? Is there maybe fear in adapting, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a general way, what you're saying, Joshua, is all right. But I think in the reality, you know, there's two parts to it. One, on our side, we're really interested in working where we can have transformative impact. As you're saying, at deep levels, at structural levels, you know, this isn't the time to just innovate for the sake of innovation and make more crap that nobody needs. You know, what's worth doing today, you know, in terms of deep innovation? And so we deliberately strategically locate ourselves in these spaces. I'd say that the question, you know, like if you think of transportation in our region, you know, we're right in the heart of the Boston, Washington megalopolis, over 30 million people living along the coast of the East Coast of New York. It's all going to flood. You know, we're going to lose airports, train systems, everything. There's no option but to face the fact that we need radical innovation. You know, so I think these are conservative spaces that are also seeing the importance of rethinking how they work. And that's, you know, where we come in, and that's where our interest is.
In a bit of thinking time here. Conservative. I'm not sure if I already want to go to that conjunction with like change. If you're thinking of innovation at some point, you're also thinking about how to implement those innovation ideas that you had and how to get the people to go with it, or to design the new way with you and not for the people. But I'm still...
I think that's something. An important point, Chris. Like, that's why we call, like, back to our name, that it's emergent, or... You know, really, the future's co-emergent. Like, you can't design things for people and expect to impose it neatly, like in this kind of future backwards way where I envision, you know, like God, a utopia, and then I'm like, everybody submit, let's make it that way. You know, those things are models for pure frustration and not for innovation, where innovation emerges. You know, so it's really, I think, like you're saying, is we have to invent processes that allow the new to co-emerge with infrastructure and people and, you know, environments, and that you can't, like, in a command and control way, just drop it down. And I think that's really where the classical ideas of creativity truly not just fail, but cause suffering and misery and terrible models of, you know, change making. And so that's really at the core of what we're trying to get to.
I think that's a magical part for me. So how to make this change, and innovation is naturally bounded to something drastically changing. And if you're talking about what did you say, radical innovation. It even sounds more, more big. And so I would say this could be also very fearful for many people. So change is about are these natural frights, so loss of control, more uncertainty, how will it be? I could lose face, I could lose status whatsoever. And normally, if you think about organizations, you have like this innovation departments, or you have like these small experimental groups or these innovation gurus doing something in a bubble or in a lab situation. And then heureka, they come out of the room and want to sell their innovation idea. How is the magic, where's the magic potion to get really everyone on board, to have it really emergent? I need something to grab here to understand. Do you have something from real life, how you make it possible with customers?
Maybe there's a bridge to the, you know, the example, Joshua, that you were talking about earlier with the Wright brothers in flight. And what the Wright brothers did differently than others at the time was they precisely didn't have some genius idea in their head, some plan what a plane should look like, and then make it real, which was what a lot of people at the time were doing. And, you know, you kind of see those people where they launch these things into the air and then somebody dies instantly, or, you know, they jump off the Eiffel Tower or some big bridge. But the Wright brothers strategically decided in a model where that, you know, it went by small steps of attuning themselves and following, forces in the world, you know. So first, like, can we make a kite be stable in the air, you know, at a certain spot? So they picked a spot in the world, like Kitty Hawk, where the wind's constant. There's these dunes that make landing possible. You know, the sand is soft. And then they started step by step building up and co-emerging. And then as they co-emerged, you know, new concepts and ideas came about and they tried them. And it's, so it's like this incremental, iterative folding in and following of forces that you're stabilizing in processes. And I think it's really the same when you scale something up or scale something down. In kind of social systems, we talk about capacity building. Like, how do you bring people in? You know, you're bringing in people before you get to change, but you're also bringing in systems and forces. And I think that's maybe the last thing to say, where, you know, you're mentioning about egos and fear. And when you realize that innovation, creativity isn't so human focused, it's about it's emerging from the middle of environments and actions, you can kind of dispel a lot of that ego.
So I think something you said that was really important, Ian, just to kind of maybe sum it up, was that the environment pushed the experiments, right? And the experiments drove the change. And the change drove the ideas that followed, right? It was not the other way around, which we traditionally think about, you know, or was happening not too far away, up the coast in, I think, you know, around Maryland, DC area, right, where they had the divine plans of how they were going to make the plane, and they were launching them over the ocean and crashing right in, right? They weren't being made by the environment. They were trying to force the environment to accept their ideas. And we certainly know who won.
Okay, I think that's another aspect. I wanted to go back to the aspect or the idea of maybe it's more about the facilitation of innovation, or if we take a classical definition of innovation, would be that it's something new and it's accepted, right? So there has to be some kind of change that's happening. And for me, I notice, I mean, I am in one of those innovation hubs, and we're working, you know, with our our own ideas, and then we're trying to integrate them and bring people involved with us. But we find often that, I find often that I lose focus of where my language or how I've developed in my thinking. And when I talk with someone who's on the working daily to produce something that's like too meta or almost in the clouds, if we try to get them to do examples, if we're practicing something, then I think that becomes easier for people to grip or to understand, or when they can feel it, you know. But I think if I'm trying to inspire people, or if I'm trying to get them to be involved, I guess, I don't know what's a rule. If I get like 3%, or then that can help to leverage those 3% to create more change. Do you guys maybe, I guess that would be two questions. Are you focusing on the people who are really motivated, in organizations? How would you speak to other teams or people involved in organizations or in the system to create this change?
I would like to just add another kind of thought there that I think is really important. So we can start by focusing on the person, the human, and we could ask a question like you're asking, how do we get them on board? How do we get them involved? But we could, you know, I think we would sort of flip that and say, how do we set up a system, an infrastructure, processes and practices that you could say organically tend or constrain people to do some things more than other things? And to see that practices and actions and environments are actually part of what pushes people and then leads them to have ideas. So I don't think you can do just one without the other, but I think it's really important not to just jump to the let's just work on the human at the level of thinking, but let's really pay attention to environments and practices and relational things. And that, you know, once those are set up well, what emerges is new ways of thinking and new habits.
So right here, I'm a bit lost in space. So I'm trying to get back to the ground, to have it practically before my eyes. So you're talking about enabling constraints. It's something we already touched before, when you told us about that Wright Brothers thing. I'm also trying to find the right meadows with the soft sand that we can spot out with the bank customer that you had. So what exactly did you change about the system? Where did you find the good meadow for the bank client, for instance? Do you have some example on that, or maybe a situation, something where things changed in a way that you like it so more systematically?
That's a really early stage one we're working on. So, you know, I think we're in the spot you are, Chris, where it's a real challenge to figure out exactly how we get to that those spots. You know, so there's like an attunement process of figuring things out early on. We're still really in that phase there. But I think like to land on the ground, like in really simple terms, we like to help people, I guess, see what's the underlying most basic way you're doing things. What are the underlying assumptions? And then what happens when you block those, when you refuse to do them, you know? So, you know, and I think that immediately leads to, it gives space for unintended things to emerge that could be experimented with or followed. So, you know, one of the techniques we often use at the beginning is just, you know, disclose underlying logics, techniques, practices, what have you, frameworks, and then strategically block those and see how you could still do, still approach your major area of interest.
Sorry to say that I'm still not seeing that before my eyes. What would be something that you then block? I need really something to touch here.
If we go back to Kitty Hawk, right? The constraints, the blocking was taking place environmentally, right? We had the wind conditions, wind direction. We have constraints of getting airborne, but also returning safely and landing. At some point, we have to steer, right? And that sort of thing. But what lacks in the process of innovation generally is that those people tend to think that no constraints is the freest form of creativity. But it's those constraints that were taking place environmentally at Kitty Hawk, right, that were driving the change. And so if we apply those constraints purposefully, right, in our work, and we say, for example, you guys invite us to your podcast and you'd like to do it in person, right? But we constrain travel because of a pandemic or just our inability to travel, right? Well, how else can we do this podcast, right? So there's some constraints that we're blocking purposely on our end, right? So that we can still accomplish some, get to some place that develops and delivers something useful and different. And here we have this virtual environment. If we're dealing with an organization, right, that has always done something this way, always traveled in this way, right? Well, we can block the most obvious ways that there's travels taking place, right, to generate some entirely new mode of transportation. Mm-hmm. Or we could block some of the ancillary elements, right? Create some artificial constraints that will still yield the traditional forms of transportation, but there'll be some difference, some change. If we go back to Joshua's, you know, definition of innovation, which is, you know, the new that's accepted, right? And so it's these constraints, these blockages that we manufacture artificially to get from the known to the unknown. And I think, you know, a step before that that's required is to understand what exists before we can block it, before we can leave it behind, right? And I think this digs deeply into ideation is, you know, rooted in what we do know. So understand what exists deeply, historically, why. Identify the main components or variables that could be blocked. Block them deeply. You know, without surrendering, without breaking down and giving into their existence, and truly generating and driving change through those constraints, and then a whole other side of this kind of opens up, which I think would take us in another direction. But generally speaking, I think that would be the process.
Mm-hmm. And so I think, Chris, maybe a good example what I've used in the past as a method is from TRIZ, which is more about a technical way to approach product development. And so what you would do is list all the pieces of and functions of a device. If it was maybe like a cutting knife, then you could list, you know, the function that you don't really want is that you cut your own finger. You know, and then you block, you would list all these parts out, and then you'd say, how do I block this from cutting myself? And then just blocking the idea of that helps to maybe, I guess, send you in another direction of where your thoughts could go, I think, would be one example.
I think for us, what's also really important here is that when you block something, you want to figure out how to block something at a paradigmatic level, you know, so it's not just, maybe to back up, if you want to have a qualitative change to happen, not just an improvement or diversification, but for something genuinely new to emerge. You know, when you disclose and figure out what's going on, you need to understand what's the underlying paradigm and what's some set of qualities of that I could block. Because if you don't do that, you're just getting a variation of what exists. But at that point, what's important is you're not trying to come up with a new product. You're trying to allow a new paradigm to emerge. You know, and after that comes into being, you can start to think about how to apply it. You know, and I think there's a set of experiments that are happening after blocking that are about the development of new paradigms, new worlds, new ways of being alive that is really critical.
I would just like add really quick in riffing on what Josh you were saying with Triz. Triz is also embedded in solutions, right? And problem solving. And I think problem solving, solution thinking gets back still to the known, right? And forecasting a predetermined outcome. Whereas we like to live in a more open-ended, emergent process that reveals itself through blocking, unintended possibilities emerge that are worth, that we can then follow. And we can determine if they're worth following, right? For a world worth making, if you will. But we're not predetermining by blocking, right? And constraining what exists. We're not trying to get to a place. We're allowing the place to reveal itself, if you will. And if we're looking carefully enough, we'll see those possibilities. So I think there's a bit of a nuance there.
I think I announced that I have some understanding questions. If you guys are talking about we have to inspect the underlying paradigm, I just realized paradigm is a word that it's kind of fuzzy for me. So what do you mean by a paradigm? Sounds somehow big. Maybe someone can give a quick definition.
Yeah. A paradigm here, we mean like the underlying assumptions behind any large way of doing things. Like, so we have a paradigm, of a kind of that humans are radical individuals, we're discrete beings, and that kind of drives a lot of things, right? So that's like a humanist, individualist paradigm of, you know, and innovation would require, you know, one form of innovation would require pushing against that.
And maybe we can also lens a bit. So I'm having two pathways and maybe you can help me steer. So on the one hand, I was interested you have on your website like this seems to me like a process. This task one, engage, task two, disclose, deviate, and emerge. We could look into this. What do you mean by that? Maybe giving a little introduction on that. So what are these steps and why these four steps? Or we could look a bit deeper into your, I would say, criticism of design thinking or conventional innovation and not radical innovation. So where do you want to go? There are two pathways now.
Well, I think they're both interconnected, right, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I think starting with design thinking might be helpful because it gives people mm-hmm. a sense. Our big criticism of design thinking and similar approaches is that if you, with design thinking, you start by empathizing with people and you say, what's your problem? You know, what's going on? But once you start in that spot, it's like the saying that, you know, is that Henry Ford was purported to say, you know, if I asked horse owners, what they wanted, they would have said, you know, a faster horse or a horse that shits less. But you wouldn't get to a car. It's like when you're trying to, you know, the horse and the car are qualitatively different. They're both modes of moving, of transportation, but they're qualitatively different modes. And they, you know, an animal-centered world of transportation or a machine-centered. And this is where things like design thinking, can't really get at the new, because you can't fundamentally ask anyone to ideate something that doesn't exist. You know, so, you know, ideation and problem-based thinking is always referencing the past. So design thinking is really good if you're trying to improve things. And if you're trying to develop something, but if you're trying to do something qualitatively different, which is, you know, what interests us, you can't approach it by asking people what their problems are and then moving mm-hmm. in a direct manner forward. But even more importantly, you can't ideate it whatsoever, right? It's, you know, if it's radically different, it won't line up with any of the terms, words, ideas, images we have. And so we have to do something else, which comes back to this whole co-emergent model, which is then what, Chris, you were describing with these stages of engage. So don't ideate, start by engaging, you know, disclosing, which is figuring out, you know, what's the underlying logic here that we can block, as well as what are unintended possibilities, and then, you know, moving from there.
Sorry, just a small interrupt. That engaging, I don't know what this means again.
So that's such a great question, but this is such a fundamental thing. It's like, if you think of all the classical images and even of how we set up, design spaces, is they're removed from the world. And we're usually start by types of ideation, like envisioning. There might be mood boards, there might be sticky notes, there might be drawings, there might be different ways of articulating what we want to do. And then we move from, you know, you could call all of that ideation. Then we move into like a type of planning phase, where it's like, well, how do we take those conceptual things and make them real? And then we carry that out in some way. Right. And so that first step is really ideation there. But ideation is conservative. So how do we not land up with something conservative is by starting by being connected, much more connected to the world. And that's why we call this first phase engage. So you don't sit in your room ideating, but I think what you see with like why we like the Wright brothers example so much is they didn't travel to Kitty Hawk with an idea and a drawing of a plane that they wanted to build, like execute and then test. They traveled to Kitty Hawk to engage with the forces there with a co-emergent plan. And that's what's really important. And so this is why I think for us, it's completely different to talk about engage versus ideate, in that the more we kind of tend back into that ideation space, back into the studio, we go back into these God models and we get what we know. And when we're dealing with complex realities, often we get nothing. Because we're trying to use a linear causal model to make change in a highly dynamic, nonlinear reality.
So I think that what you describe is probably good for research as well. I mean, and why research is probably should be one of the models for future, I guess, of just academics. I guess this jump is really big, you know, from incremental innovation to radical innovation. I think what you guys also talk about quite a bit, which is also where Dave Snowden has also been very active, is the idea of exaption. So it's like, I'm not just completely new things that are out of this world and being brought here. It's maybe I'm adapting something from this field and bringing it into another field where it's still new and could be radically different than for what they've been using, but maybe it's been established with core functions or beliefs or values in another area, maybe.
Yeah. Exaptation, which is a word from biological evolutionary theory, which means to use something for its non-intended purpose, essentially, or to discover some part of it that was never intended for anything and to use it for a purpose. It's really, we could simplify it and say it's like co-opting things. But now what's really important in that is that you can co-opt, and we do this every day, we co-opt things for unintended purposes, like you co-opt your chair to be a ladder. But that's where you're doing it, you're using it for something that already exists, ladders. And, we use our shoes to help open wine bottles or, whatever it might be. But the co-opting things for new and unintended purposes is what's really challenging. And I think that's the part that really interests us. And that's where, looking closer at evolution is really interesting, where things like flight wasn't just, taking a feather that existed to keep dinosaurs warm, and magically flight emerged. But there's this complex set of deviations that leads to it that really interests us, because that, taking the model from evolution into human practices, I think leads to really interesting outcomes. And that's why we talk a lot about blocking, because blocking is inherently, if you say you can't use this for that, all that's left is co-opting it. And if you block well enough, all that's left is co-opting for the new.
One of the things that really struck me when I read through your page, you had this note on be problem blind or come up with a new better problem. I think when I read it the first time, I was a bit puzzled and like, what? But yeah, the more we talk and after digging a bit deeper, I began to understand. I'm curious. So you were talking what is interesting to you guys, and speaking about our podcast, we are very much interested in the term of collaboration. So if we are talking about how can we be creative or innovative, I would add in how can we be creative together. So I'm not sure if we touched that very deeply. Do we have something in that area? So because what you said before is more like a general approach, how to attack the innovation task, but how to do it together in a good fashion.
Yeah, I think you need everybody, right? Like, it's not, again, going back to the individual, right? It's not in one person, even with one person with a great process that they stick to and follow, right? It's that we need a more distributed model, right? That it's not us against them, but we're a collective working towards some outcome. It's that we're learning from one another's work, right? And following the interesting, following the new to some different destination. So it's relational, right? It's we're everything has agency. We're being informed and informing through the work of the collective, right? It's not just a person. So us working together, right, is critical.
Mm-hmm. I would add, what you're hinting at, Jason, is that most of the most important collaborations we have are not just with people, but with our environments and tools and processes. That when we get out of the God model, like it's just me and my idea, and you enter a much more emergent model, you're collaborating with your immediate environment and it's shaping you, you know, and you're working with others because, you know, a lot of these things are very hard to sense and you might not notice something somebody else will. So you need these large kind of collaborative, sensitive models. I'd just say collaboration is more than human, is really critical to be creative.
Okay. And the time is running down here. We'd like to give you guys the opportunity to have your own drum solo, maybe something that we missed or something that you would like to share with us. Yeah, let it rip.
I would just say really fast, I know a lot of this can sound highly abstract. It can sound, you know, overwhelming or theoretical. What's really useful is just to try and experiment at home today, you know, with these ideas of, say, blocking. I imagine most of you will cook dinner. And as you go to cook dinner, just block something fundamental. I would suggest blocking that you're going to use. You're going to make something that normally requires heat, but don't use heat. So, for example, rice or pasta or potatoes are on the menu for dinner. Make it without heat or water. And you'll see how quickly unintended capacities of the system of spaghetti and rice and potatoes emerge, and you have to follow them, and it's no longer in your head.
Yeah, and the last thing I would say is we're often accused of hating on design thinking, but we don't hate it. In fact, I think it's a really critical part of innovation. It's just that it comes at the end of the process as opposed to the beginning, right? And so to engage, as Ian described earlier, right, and disclose what exists in order to block it and deviate and leave it behind, to follow unintended possibilities to new worlds, right? That's the first half of innovation. That's the disruptive, qualitative, you know, innovation side of things that we think is largely overlooked and ignored. After you have a world worth making, right, then it's critical to get to that incremental, iterative, developmental side of innovation in which design thinking, you know, agile fits so well, and they're so critical, you know, to the other, you know, to that latter half of innovation. And we have a lot of great tools, you know, for that second half of innovation. It's this first half of this disruptive innovation that, you know, really is our area of focus.
I liked so much when Ian talked about that home situation, and I kind of had a trick question in my sleeve. I do not have a sleeve right now, but I wanted to ask you. Yeah, that's also a sleeve. Yeah, right. How does your theory or work reflect or have an effect in your personal life? Is there something that you could name?
I think, you know, it definitely has a profound impact in my daily life, where, you know, one example would be, you know, I got rid of all the furniture in my house. Like I decided to block furniture and just, you know, what does it mean to just be connected to the ground plane? You know, and I think, you know, and what emerges, what changes, so I think we practice and experiment with this in our daily lives all the time, where we're trying to always see what's an underlying logic, how does it materialize, what could we block, how could we do something different. Mm-hmm. It can't just be what you take to the office, and it can't just be a theory.
Jason, do you have also an impact in your life?
I would just say... you know, blocking, you know, any traditional standard approach to doing things, right? It just I want to create some difference. Well, I'm not going to do that, right? And so, not quite as radical as my furniture, but I think in just approaches to observations of, what's traditionally done in the mainstream and blocking those traditional elements to kind of generate some difference. And, you know, I think we get accused of doing some of that in our LinkedIn shares from time to time.
Okay. Extended the time box long enough. Joshua, why don't you wrap it up?
Okay, great. It was great to have you guys here and be in dialogue with each other. I would recommend our listeners to subscribe to you guys' newsletter. I enjoy that very much. It's once a week. We'll also check you guys out on LinkedIn. We'll have all those things in the show notes and connections to you guys' profiles. Yeah, thank you very much. And yeah, until the next time.
Until the next time. Super, super great talking. Really stimulating. Thank you.
Chris, Josh, cool. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. It's terrific.
Great.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you both. Right. Really appreciate it. Wonderful talking.
Sie haben eine neue Nachricht. Erste Nachricht. Empfangen Sonntag, 30. Oktober um 17.33 Uhr.
Hi Josh, yeah, I know it's kind of late, but you know, I just tried this this blocking heat and water for cooking thingy, and yeah, my kids were kind of pissed, and thing is, just got a fusilli stuck in my eyeball now. Could you maybe drive me to the hospital real quick? Thank you, buddy. Beep.